This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
Hello and welcome to Mountain News. I'm your host, Rachel Geringer, and in this episode, we bring you stories about plants, people, and industries, and the ways they interact throughout the Appalachian region. The Moth Main Stage returns to Apple Shop this September after making its Appalachian debut right here in Whitesburg in the spring of 2018. Since its launch in 1997, the Moth has presented thousands of stories told live and without notes. Moth shows are renowned for the great range of human experience they showcase. And since each story is true and every voice authentic, the shows dance between documentary and theater, creating a unique, intimate, and often enlightening experience for the audience. I hopped on the phone with director Jennifer Hickson to hear more about the Moth's upcoming show in the Apple Shop Theater on Friday, September 13th.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Hickson, a senior director at The Moth, and one of the hosts of The Moth Radio Hour.
Great. And what is The Moth?
The Moth, true stories told live. That's the short and sweet answer, because we don't allow people to bring paper on stage, and people are just telling stories from their hearts, although that's a little deceiving because we do work with the storytellers to shape the story and help people decide, oh, where should this start, or what's the part you should put in or leave out. But the Moth is people from all walks of life, definitely not necessarily performers, regular folks sharing episodes from their life, things that changed them.
And I guess, yeah, just curious kind of what some of the history of the Moth is and how it came into existence. It seems like it's evolved somewhat over the years.
Yes, well, the Moth was born on a porch in the south on St. Simon's Island, where George Dawes Green would sit out with a bunch of friends and tell stories, and they decided to not interrupt each other and just let somebody have the floor. Tell us a story. And they would drink bourbon, and there were some holes in the screen, and moths would flutter in through the holes. And then by the end, the screened-in porch was filled with moths, so they named themselves the Moth.
How does the Moth work? It seems like there are different live events in different parts of the country and also in New York. Is that true?
Yes. Well, our home was New York, although it was born in the South. Then it migrated to New York City. But now we have shows in over 30 cities, and we travel around with our main stage series. At Apple Shop, we're going to be bringing you a main stage show, and that means there's five stories. And the show is kind of purposely balanced out by the director, who's me in this case, and we have a host to guide you through the night. We also have things called story slams that happen regularly in many other cities, and that's just anybody can show up. There's a theme. We have no idea what's going to happen in the night, so that's exciting.
So the Moth is coming back to Whitesburg, and I wonder if you could tell us kind of when and where that's happening and also what people can expect from that show.
Yes. Well, the show's at the Apple Shop Theater on 91 Madison Avenue in Whitesburg. The doors open at 6:30. The show's at 7:30. We're going to have a host who's going to introduce you and tell you a bit about the Moth. Then we're going to have five storytellers, three in the first half and two in the second half. And they're going to bring you a bunch of different places, into some of their families, into their dynamics of where they've been and their experiences as human beings. Some stories are quite funny, and some are, you know, more poignant, moving. There's a couple of big surprises in them. And, yeah, I think there will be people you absolutely recognize in the stories and some who you will be, wow, I've never met that person before. So,
if people aren't familiar with the Moth, where can they go to kind of get a sense for what those main stage shows are like and get a little bit of a taste of what they could expect?
Yes, you can visit themoth.org. We have a website, and there are hundreds and hundreds of stories on there that you can pick out. You could just choose randomly, or you could scroll down till you see a name you like, or a lot of the stories have titles, so those might entice you in some way. They're not stories with an agenda. They're not designed to change your mind or drive you to action, and makes you laugh, hopefully, a lot of times. Sometimes it makes you cry. It's just fun to be in someone else's shoes for a little bit.
Next, we'll hear a recording from the Moth main stage show that took place in the Appleshop Theater in May of 2018. That show marked the Moth's Appalachian and rural debut. This is Jacob Karuba from Harlan County, Kentucky, telling a story live on stage in 2018.
So I was born in Harlan County, Kentucky. My mother realized in the beginning that I was special when she discovered that I only had four fingers on my right hand. I was raised in Cumberland, Kentucky. I was raised by my mother and a whole gaggle of aunts. Cumberland is a small town. We had as many liquor stores as we did churches. And had you blinked while driving through, you'd have probably missed it. But growing up in Cumberland was never quite that easy. You never had a lot. I got picked on a bit as a kid, you know, especially in the winter because I had to wear mittens. Gloves didn't fit right. It was, I'm sorry. I normally spent most of my time alone in my room playing with my Batman action figures. And if I did get to play with someone that wasn't family, it was either at a vocational Bible school or there was one kid in the projects that would play basketball with me in the mornings, real early if there was no other kids around to play with. When I was around 13, I finally started high school, and I managed to make one friend. It was my buddy Josh. He was a couple grades ahead of me, and he asked me one day if I wanted to have a ride home. I said, of course, yeah, I wanted to be that cool kid. So as we're exiting the schoolhouse, I can remember seeing his old white beat-up Cavalier. He had put a big red duct-taped X on the top of it that we had lovingly started calling the old General Lee. As we were heading to my house, he asked me if I wanted to listen to some music. Of course, I said yes. As he popped in a CD, all I could remember hearing was, "We are 138! I was like, oh my God, what is this? Like, I'm still getting chill bumps. But I didn't say anything. I just reached over and snatched up the CD. As I was looking at the CD, this was the first time that I'd ever seen the Misfits. It was these four big buff dudes, you know, huge devil locks, eyeliner, black leather pants. And I can remember thinking, it's like, I bet nobody messes with these guys. It wasn't a week later, I had Josh cut me my first mohawk. And I started begging my mother for earrings. Now, my transition into punk music, it wasn't very quick. I can remember going to the local dollar store and buying hair dye and nail polish. And I can remember sneaking into my mom's room and stealing her makeup and her black pantyhose to like wear on my arms and stuff. I was so cool. We didn't even have piercing parlors in Cumberland. So anything that we did, we normally did with a safety pin and a nail. Yeah. I got my first nose ring. We were at my friend Evan's house. And while we were hanging out, we were playing Smackdown on his PlayStation 1. And one of us had the random thought, we need to do a piercing. Of course, I volunteered. I've still got the hole. And I went into the bathroom with this nail and safety pin that we had boiled for what we thought was a safe amount of time. And I can remember shoving the safety pin through and pulling it out. Shoving the nail in. You had to gauge the hole. Pulled it out. And I finally got my nose ring in. Now, coming home every week or so with these new holes in my head, my mother wasn't the judgmental type. She accepted everyone, and she, my mother was the most beautiful woman. It didn't matter your color, your creed, your religious background, alcoholism. You were always welcomed at our table. It was a beautiful thing. She even trusted us when we would go out of town, even local here, to go to punk shows, go to rock shows. But no matter where we went, my mother would always ask, make sure you're safe. Call me. So, and if I didn't call her, she would find the number. She would always ask me, what are you doing? Did you eat? And even at that time, me and my mom was still going to church. Like, I can remember walking into the church and the preacher meeting me at the door. And while he was shaking his head and my hand at the same time, he said, I don't know how many holes you're going to have next week, but I'm glad you're here. Now, while he accepted me, my mother was always there for us. The rest of the people in the churches would normally just turn and stare, the same as most of the other people in town. So I realized I started building up these walls through my looks and my music. I had to feel safe. I had to have my friends safe. My mother had to be safe. So as I was delving deeper into the punk scene, right when I had started feeling safe, my mother had her first stroke. This was rough. I can remember I started falling further and further behind in school, and I started having the realization that nothing could mean more to me than my family. So my third freshman year, I finally quit school. At this point, my normal everyday routine became, I would get up in the morning, fix my hair, help my mother into the shower. I would cook us breakfast. After we would eat, I'd give her a hug and kiss and tell her I loved her, and I would go off on a journey in Cumberland, Kentucky to find work. And finding work in Cumberland was never easy. But there were a few older women. They were always there for us. They had known me and my family long enough that they didn't really judge. So you could be driving down the road and see this dude with a foot-tall mohawk just weeding gardens. Or maybe your kids would come home one day and just see this dude covered in piercings, like cooking your family dinner, and just got done cleaning the house. It wasn't easy, but it's what we had. We had each other. We had love. And then when I finally got old enough, I decided to become a bartender, like my mother had done for so many years of my childhood. And one day while I'm at work, I get this phone call. My mother wasn't breathing. I left everything as it was at the bar. I hopped on my bicycle. I rode as quickly as I could to the house. As I got up to the door, I can remember seeing my mother laying in the floor, not breathing. I rush over to her. I start giving her CPR. I gave her CPR for at least 30 minutes. I knew she was gone after 15. As I was sitting there, there was no one in the house but me and her at that point. And it felt like this emotional black hole had opened up inside me. Like I was trying to take everything in, but nothing could come out. I was lost. Finally, the coroner showed up. He ruled it as a heart attack. I even had to help load my mother into the hearse and watch him drive away. There was a few people had gathered outside during all of this commotion. And, I mean, I couldn't stand to be around those people. So I called my friend Josh. He came and picked me up in that same old white Cavalier. He didn't say a word, and we went straight to his house. And as I was sitting there, trying to drown my sorrows, listening to Dashboard Confessional, the phone rang. That was my lowest point in my life. I realized that my mother wasn't calling. So the next morning, I had to get up and leave. I had to sell everything in our apartment because I couldn't afford rent. Had to handle all of the funeral arrangements. The only thing that I kept was a garbage bag full of clothes and my bed. I was homeless for about 3 months. One day, I got a phone call from a friend that I'd actually went to vocational Bible school with. It'd been almost 10 years since I'd heard from him. He offered me a leg up, you know, a way out. I took it. The end of 2010, I moved from Cumberland, Kentucky. That's when I realized, looking back, had it not been for my friends and my music and my look, I don't know where I'd be at today. I'd realized that all of these huge walls that I'd built throughout my entire life, they needed to change. Slowly, they started turning into a chain link fence, you know, something I could finally see through. I wanted the world to see me for the man I was and the man my mother always knew that I should be. Thank you.
That was Jacob Karuba from Harlan County, Kentucky, telling a true story live on stage at the Apple Shop in May 2018 as a part of the Moth's Appalachian debut. The Moth returns to Apple Shop on Friday, September 13th at 7:30 p.m. For more information, find Apple Shop on Facebook. Next, from the Ohio Valley Resource, we learn about a rare plant that's making a comeback by moving off of the endangered species list. Glynis Board brings us the saga of the running buffalo clover.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is taking a rare species of plant off the endangered species list this week. Amid controversial proposals to change the law protecting rare species, the running buffalo clover is an example of a successful recovery. It's a plant we all know and love, or we think we do, the clover. But one species of clover was thought to be extinct until someone found it in West Virginia 30 years ago. Biologist Rodney Bartkus recalls his discovery was met with some skepticism.
We were walking along the trail, and I told Cloyce, hey, there's running buffalo clover. And he said, no, it's extinct. And I said, Cloyce, that's it. And he bet me a steak dinner that was not running buffalo clover, and I got that steak dinner. So that's how it was rediscovered.
After Bartkus reported the find, running buffalo clover was moved onto the endangered species list. Today he's hiking with Melissa Thomas Van Gundy, a research forester with the Forest Service, stationed here at the Furneaux Experimental Forest in West Virginia. It's one place where you can find the clover.
Part of the running part comes from these stolons, these plant parts that are like a strawberry runner.
For years, Thomas Van Gundy has been helping to manage the populations of running buffalo clover found here.
Of course, it's not blooming right now, but that is a really good way to identify it.
These clover are not like the ones you find in your yard. They're much more sensitive. They can't tolerate full sun, full shade, or severe disturbance. That said, Thomas Van Gundy explains they love heavy machinery. She explains that in this particular tract of land, forest managers use heavy machinery every 10 years or so on paths they call skid roads.
When we first found this, I think it was along this trail somewhere, mm-hmm. We said, okay, well, Fish and Wildlife Service says, you guys, we can't disturb those plants. Put your skid road up there. Don't use this skid road. Okay, we did that, came back in. Plant numbers had dropped where we hadn't run over them. They showed up on the new skid road. So it's a kind of a frustrating plant if you think you have to stay off of it.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service listed the clover as endangered in 1987. Since then, more populations have been found and monitored. Today, about 150 populations are known to exist in 6 states. Many of these populations are on public lands or they're on private land with conservation agreements. Thomas Van Gundy and Bartkus say protecting these rare plants is an important part of maintaining the protective benefits of biodiversity. They say a more diverse forest is more resilient to disease, pointing out that humans ultimately depend on healthy ecosystems for clean air and water. But Bartkus says his motivation to protect the running buffalo clover is also rooted in the value of the stories it tells.
Just imagine standing right here and a herd of mastodon comes through. We know that that happened fairly routinely. That's what this, that's the disturbance making that most of these species evolved in. So, you know, once the mastodons and things like that died out, they relied upon, you know, the buffalo and the elk. So we can go back to that story. And now they rely on us.
When asked if he thought delisting the clover was a good idea, Bartkus said he felt all right about it. But the running buffalo clover isn't quite out of the woods, so to speak. Bartkus pointed to stilt grass and other invasives that could displace more delicate native species. So it's important, he adds, to continue to keep an eye and maybe a reintroduced elk hoof on them. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Glynis Board in the Furneaux Experimental Forest in West Virginia.
Last in this episode of Mountain News, Sydney Bowles brings us an interview with Scott Shoup, a former Harlan County miner who quit mining to receive training in the energy efficiency industry instead.
The weeks-long Blackville miners' blockade in Harlan County has breathed new life into conversations about coal's place in the eastern Kentucky economy. One person who spent time at the blockade was Scott Shoup, a former coal miner who now works in renewable energy and energy efficiency. I spoke with Scott about his experience as a leader in the coal industry and what made him want to move on.
I started in the coal industry in January of 1995, and you know, I started just like anybody else does, you know, with just a 40-hour training class and, you know, no experience, and started shoveling belt. I tell you, I got my first job in the mines. I have been aggravating people to death. I mean, this is the mid-90s. Arch is shutting down and leaving our area. So get on in the coal industry at that time. It was really, really tough. But like I said, as soon as I got my 5 years in, I got my foreman's papers and, you know, I started pre-shifting, doing fireball stuff. Then I bossed on the section on productions, and then I bossed on the section on move crews. And, you know, then just as time progressed, you know, I just moved up to mine foreman and superintendent. And then when you know, Alpha sold out. I took a job over a production efficiency group for them that traveled throughout the entire company.
I guess I just wonder, yeah, can you talk a little bit about what you learned about the coal industry by being a leader in it?
With some people, man, just, you know, cutting corners, it just becomes a norm because everything from the top down is all about, you know, production and numbers and, you know, you got to meet quota or you don't stay in your job. And, you know, that's just how the coal industry's always been. And I guess that's the reason why that it does have somewhat of a bad reputation, is that, you know, people are mistreated and people, you know, their safety is neglected. And, you know, I've seen a lot of that firsthand, you know, in places that I worked with and visited in West Virginia, more so than I had ever seen it here. And then when I went to Alabama, I mean, it was horrible. And, you know, and that was a lot of the reason why that I chose, you know, to leave the industry. And then, you know, plus with that, you know, being a superintendent and other positions, I mean, you get a lot of that, you know, you get a lot of the blunt force on, you know, the emails and the calls, you know, and the constant hassle of, you know, why ain't you doing this? Why don't you have this done? You know, and I've been in situations where that, you know, I told you know, people that worked under me, you know, not to set a feeder or, you know, not to do something this way. And then, you know, you have other management higher than me, you know, come in and force people to do things, you know, that are unsafe. You know, I mean, I seen that you know, time and time again. And then you, myself, I push back a lot, you know, and, you know, would tell people, you know, that I'm not making guys do that, that it is unsafe. And, you know, it just becomes a constant attack to where that, you know, you're fighting with other management more than you're accomplishing anything. And that's how it was for me. I mean, it got to the point to where I spent all of my time defending myself and my men. And I knew that, you know, it was just a matter of time before they found a way to push me out. You know what I mean?
It's just so interesting to me to think about, like, you know, little Scotty in the basement of the house, so excited to grow up and be a miner, you know, like playing coal miner
right
under the house, to, you know, college age Scott, who's like, I don't, you know, I'm going to try and do something else. I'm going to start my own business, to, you know, spending years, like trying to, you know, doing well, rising in the ranks. Evidently doing well to be promoted so many times. And now to feeling like, your focus on, you know, safety and regulations makes you, a liability. So how are you, like, you know, you're thinking, you're seeing all these unsafe practices. How does this all change, like, the way you thought about, I don't know, your uncles growing up or the work that all the men in your community did? How is this changing the way that you think about the whole economy here?
Well, I mean, the whole economy, I mean, as far as, I mean, I know that if we don't get some other industry in here, then, I mean, these towns are going to sink. I mean, they're going under. I mean, we're in dire need of some other industry. I mean, people can sit and argue all they want about, you know, liking coal, disliking coal, but anybody that has any direct true knowledge of the coal industry knows that it's not a profitable long-term business. It's not. I mean, and all of that started years ago when all this technology and, you know, and all the other advances in the mining industry, that all comes with a price, you know. And so, I mean, I think it's inevitable that, I mean, we need industry here yesterday. It's no different than putting a dog inside a fence, and every time you go by the fence, you open that door and kick it. Eventually, that dog's going to bite you. I mean, it's no different. These people you're talking to just haven't hit that experience. It's just like drug addicts and alcoholics. When they find out for themselves that they're at rock bottom, they make a change and get help. And it's the same thing with the coal industry. When the coal industry takes enough from people, then they'll change their mind and they'll see the same thing I've seen. When, you know, that's just like this ordeal that people's going through over there. This is the first time that I've ever talked to people associated with the coal industry that are saying it's over. You know, when stuff directly affects you and your pocket, you start paying attention to it. We can't take what people have spent their lives working for, just take it away from them. We can't do that to people. That's not American.
That was Scott Shoup of Harlan County. For WMMT, I'm Sydney Bowles. That's it for this episode of Mountain News, featuring a song called Blackie Rag. That's B-L-A-C-K-E-Y, as in the small town in Letcher County, Kentucky. That song comes from Marion Sumner's 1979 album, Road to Home, which was released on Apple Shop's own June Apple label. If you'd like to hear this or previous episodes again, you can find them on our website at wmmt.org. Or download Mountain News as a podcast on SoundCloud or Stitcher. I've been your host, Rachel Geringer, and from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio.
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.